Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. We have with us today Emily Grayson and Jeff Adams, both marine ecologists with the UW College of the Environment and Washington Sea Grant. Emily is also the program lead of Washington Sea Grant's CRAB team. Together with marine ecologist Jeff Adams, she oversees a comprehensive program focused on early detection, monitoring, and control of the European green crab, considered one of the world's worst invasive species. Emily spends a lot of time in the mud, working with volunteers and managers to document sightings of this green crab and track the species' impacts. Jeff, who first launched the program, also works on a wide range of aquatic and watershed issues, including aquatic invasive species prevention. Welcome, Emily and Jeff.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Both of you are skilled experts on aquatic invasive species. Can you tell us what connotates a species that is invasive?
Sure. And my answer to this is often a frustrating one, in that it sometimes depends on who you ask. That is, I'm an invasion biologist by training, and so I have a definition of an invasive species that isn't exactly the same or isn't identical to what a manager would call an invasive species. So in both groups, I think we can agree that an invasive species is one that spent the majority of its evolutionary history in a different part of the world. And evolution is an important part of the definition of an invasive species, because every species evolves in response to other species. And the lack of a shared evolutionary history in a new range is often what creates the disruption that can lead to what we consider invasive species that cause economic damage.
Jeff, what are some of the aquatic invasive species currently found in Washington State?
There's quite a few, and there's a couple different levels to that. There's those that are found here, and there's those that we hope to keep from establishing themselves here. And a few that come to mind are things like bullfrogs and northern pike, the large fish that's in some of the waterways in the Columbia, the African clawed frog, which is common in the pet trade. And unfortunately, pets often get released when their owners aren't comfortable with them anymore or don't have space for them. And Spartina is a cord grass from the eastern U.S. that has been controlled for a number of years out here on marine estuaries and coastal shorelines. And we even have things like crayfish and nutria. Nutria is kind of like a beaver with a rat tail that came from South America.
So they come from all over the globe, it sounds like. Is that true?
That's true. And that's one of the really key parts of trying to manage and address invasive species issues is thinking about where they come from, but also just how they get here. What are the mechanisms by which they arrive in our waterways and our landscapes? You know, whether they're released at, you know, from being pets, as I mentioned, or maybe they catch a ride on or in the water carried by a ship. There's all sorts of different vectors that we kind of think about when we're trying to think about how can we prevent them from spreading. And, you know, we think about where they come from to arrive here. Also, how the species from here can play a role as invasive species elsewhere. I mentioned nutria as a problem from South America here, and, you know, our beloved by some beaver from our neck of the woods is actually causing a lot of ecological changes in southern South America. So it's kind of a give and take, and being aware of the ways that they move is a great way to both control what gets here and help prevent ours from causing problems elsewhere.
Well, that's really a good point. Today, we are talking about a very specific program that is focused on monitoring in the Salish Sea and ultimately removing a very specific species called the European green crab. Emily, tell us about this particular crab.
This crab is one of the species that has a reputation for being one of the most damaging in the world. It's made it on the top of a lot of lists of people who think exclusively about invasive species. And what that typically means is that it's been really successful at establishing populations outside of its native range. and that its successful establishment has often led to economic and ecological harm in those places. So the European green crab, as you might guess by its name, its native range is in the northeastern Atlantic Ocean from roughly the North Sea down to the northern coast of Africa. And it's established populations in almost every temperate marine habitat across the planet. So we're talking about the southeast coast of South America, Australia, of Africa, South Africa in particular, and particularly the east coast of the United States, where it's been not only established, but growing its population and range since for more than 200 years. So this species, from what we've seen in other places, is causing a great deal of concern here because it has impacts in all of these other places. It likes to be a predator, so it eats a lot of the same seafood that we like to eat, like bivalves, clams, and other shellfish. And one of the particularly damaging impacts that we're concerned about is that it can impair the restoration and maintenance of eelgrass beds, eelgrass being a really important ecological foundation species for, among other things, salmonids in our region.
Interesting. I mean, it really sounds like it's devastating to the location that it settles into. And I understand that the crab first arrived in Washington and Vancouver Island in the late 1990s, but that population was only sustained on Vancouver Island. And the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife wanted the crabs to be monitored on inland Washington shores for those very reasons that you were just describing. It's so devastating, with the goal of preventing them from taking a hold and devastating our shoreline ecosystems. So can you give us a little more detail about that? Is it showing up other places?
Sure. And to even take another step back, the European green crab has been on the west coast of North America since at least the late 1980s, where it was first found in San Francisco Bay. And from there, it did spread over the next decade or so to Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, while staying established in California. But that initial range expansion on the sort of the outer coast part of Washington state, that actually didn't really take hold at the time. The crabs were numerous for a couple of years, and particularly in our coastal estuaries, Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor. But then the numbers really dropped, and even some monitoring that's been done since then on a limited scale has been unable to detect them in some years, until within the last 5 to 6 years or so, numbers really increased across the west coast of North America. And in particular, these are the years when Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife became more concerned about green crabs expanding their range into the Salish Sea, as you mentioned. And so with the detection of a population, the very first one that was found along in this inland shores was actually on the BC side at a place called Souk Basin, which is just west of Victoria. And having that crab so close to Puget Sound and other Washington inland shorelines really created a lot of concern, such that WDFW wanted to proactively get out there and find populations of green crabs before they were so large that there basically wasn't anything we could do about controlling them.
This program is unique for many reasons. Among them is that this monitoring program began before green crab were found in the Salish Sea. It was preemptive. What is meant by preemptive monitoring?
That's a great question, and it really is one of the core principles of managing biological invasions. We do as much as we can to prevent the species moving around the world in ways like you heard Jeff talking about earlier. We really try to control the vectors, and prevention is the most cost-effective way to prevent an invasion. But knowing that we can't prevent every species, especially those in marine habitats that often get washed around on the tides and currents that, you know, make our ocean, what we, the next best tool we have in our toolkit, it's called early detection and then followed by rapid response. EDRR is the fun technical jargon we often use. And so what we're trying to do is get out ahead of any evidence of the invasion to really look with a fine tooth comb at all of the places we think a species could arrive first and could, where it could set up shop, where it could establish a foothold to grow a population rapidly. So that's really what the monitoring program was built around within the Salish Sea, was getting out there with traps before evidence of green crab populations were even detectable.
Before they're even there, right. Well, Jeff, is this the first crab team monitoring program in the nation to preemptively try to remove an invasive species?
Yeah, good question. It's not the first. You know, there's been many attempts to kind of monitor for invasive species of all types. And probably one of the biggest efforts, you know, outside of, you know, green crab is around the zebra and quagga mussels and their movements out toward the western U.S. The western states are deeply involved in investing heavily in trying to prevent the further spread. And that includes monitoring, both from monitoring DNA in the water, as well as physically looking and visually monitoring or putting out little traps, much as Crab Team does. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the time we kind of start looking once we find something somewhere. And that was one of the strengths of Crab Team, is that, you know, we knew they were in the area, but we had a chance to look before they were here and hoped to never find them. But of course, we were successful in finding them. But there are a lot of programs for other things, too. And again, going back to the Spartina example, that's one where a lot of investment went into controlling it once people recognized that it was spreading and causing harm. And of course, once that investment had paid off and the populations were down, folks still needed to be out and on the lookout for additional places where it was growing so that control could continue. So that's another way in which that monitoring can be helpful.
And as you mentioned, it is no longer preemptive, as your volunteers did, in fact, find the first invasive European green crab on San Juan Island in 2016, and more have been found since then. Emily, can you tell us about how many to date?
So since 2016, when the very first European green crab was captured along Washington's inland shorelines, steadily since that year, we have seen an increasing number of detection sites. And at some of those sites, we've seen an increasing number of crabs from year to year. The good news is that at most of those sites, we're really talking about one to fewer than 10 crabs found as a result of setting hundreds, sometimes even thousands of traps. And that's over the course of 4 or 5 years. So in most of these sites, most population numbers indicate that the crabs are pretty sparse. At a few sites, we're starting to see more crabs, and that's on the order of dozens to hundreds. And in one case at least, there's, you know, been over 1,000 crabs. These are the sites that we're much more concerned about.
As you mentioned, it's some places there are fewer and some places there are more being found. The progress of the crab team efforts have been regularly reported in local newspapers. And I read that in Drayton Harbor during just the first week of trapping this summer, they yielded the highest number of crabs at 40. Any other updates on that? What's the update for Drayton Harbor and those other sites?
Drayton Harbor is definitely one of the current hotspots of concern within the Salish Sea. And this year, we launched a collaborative management effort with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, who had two dedicated technicians to just Drayton Harbor, as well as a local coordinator from the Northwest Straits Commission, who provided field and logistical coordination. And that team was able to accomplish quite a bit. They set more than 3,000 traps over from May through October and removed a total of 253 European green crabs. So a fair number of green crabs, but again, they had to set more than 3,000 traps to find all of those crabs. It still remains a really concerning sight. In particular, we saw towards the end of the season the arrival of a new year class, young of the year crabs, that indicate that there will be an ongoing need to trap in that location.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I am Marianne Wagner, today's host of Coastal Cafe, and we're speaking with Emily Grayson and Jeff Adams, both marine ecologists with the UW College of the Environment and Washington Sea Grant. We've been talking about aquatic invasive species, and we have a few more questions for you. It sounds like your team's efforts to stop the spread of the invasive European green crab are impressive. Managers and volunteers collectively peppered Washington's inland shorelines with more than 11,000 traps this past year, and that's more than any previous year. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this program just started with a small pilot in 2015 and has ramped up consistently every year as we learn more and find more places to explore and more particular places where we find, you know, if we find a green crab and some response is required, or just the overall need and effort and involvement, and the involvement of both community members, which is critical to crab team's monitoring effort, and also WDFW's ability to add people into the field, add techs and employees to actually increase the trapping in particular areas of concern, has been really impressive. And, you know, this, you know, each year we do learn a little something more that prompts us to kind of redouble efforts. And this last year was no different. But there's also elements of hope and in some of the trapping and the results of it.
And Emily, at Dungeness Spit, there's some good news, isn't there?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite parts of 2020 to talk about. And so for folks who have been tracking green crab pretty closely for the last few years might recall that Dungeness Spit was what we might have considered our first, quote, hot spot, where we found more than just a small handful of crabs, and so initiated a removal trapping effort. And the Spit is a National Wildlife Refuge property, so it's managed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who has been doing really intensive removal trapping efforts since 2017 to just try to consistently go out there and trap and trap and trap and pull green crab as much as possible to prevent them from becoming both established locally within Dungeness Bay, but then also from reproducing there and allowing any larvae that are released at that site to get transported further into the Salish Sea. So it's both important for local protection of the refuge lands itself, as well as the regional management effort. And the good news is that this is the first year since 2017 that they've seen a really dramatic drop in the average capture rate. So we talk about the number of crabs captured, but the average capture rate, that is for a given number of traps that you set, how many crabs do you catch? That's sort of what we use as our thermometer to track how the population might be changing over time, how easy it is to catch them. And for the last few years, the number held steady around 2 crabs for every 100 trap sets. But this year, that number tanked down, you know, to a tenth or less of that. And that's really good news because it means that the trapping there has been effective at removing the crabs that were living there, and that we've also had a little bit of help from nature. That is, we haven't seen, as we did in previous years, a lot of larvae getting washed in from coastal areas. And so both of those factors together have helped reduce the numbers of green crabs there, and the folks there will continue to do at least some monitoring to make sure that, you know, numbers don't go up again if there's more larvae coming in. But in general, we're quite pleased to see that some trapping in certain conditions can yield some local control.
So what is actually involved in monitoring for our green crab? And I should add, Emily, that you have been hauling a load of fish in the back of your car at times, and that must leave a bit of a smell.
Well, it's usually the purview of my dog, the back of my car, so she mostly doesn't mind. But I have been told that my car has a little bit of an ocean smell by at least the more polite passengers in their car. So there's the program requires doing a lot of interesting tasks in order to get, you know, we work at 55 monitoring sites, and equipping volunteers and partners to do this type of work always yields sort of funny stories about hauling 800 pounds of fish in the back of your subcompact size Scion XA. Thankfully, we've actually gotten big enough now that my car is no longer sufficient. And we, you know, work with the University Fleet Services to get a proper pickup truck and have somebody with a forklift load our bait for us into the truck. So we feel we've grown into it. But as anyone who's sort of started any similar type of program knows, at the beginning, you sort of are, you do all things and you do them in whatever way gets them done, and involves lots of trips to Home Depot and lots of creativity. And so in terms of what that looks like and in terms of monitoring, part of the hauling fish is because we create a monitoring network where all of the sites are monitored the same way over across all 55 of them. And then from month to month, we're doing monitoring in the same way so that we can compare the changes over space and time. And the reason that means that I have to haul 800 pounds of fish in my car from time to time is because we provide the bait. So we're using the same bait at all of the other sites, all of the sites the same amount of bait in every single trap, more or less. And for those of you crabbers who are interested, we use mackerel as our bait because it's gross, frankly, because it's gross. And it's oily. It's an oily fish. It's a bloody fish. And that means it creates a lot of odor for crabs to come to. So it's a good fish for us to use for this program.
Yeah, I was going to ask what your fish of choice was. Good to know. And I understand, Emily, that the crab team also has many partners. All have been critical to the success of the program that you've experienced to date. And so who are some of your partners?
Right. The 11,000 traps that were set in 2020, certainly that's not me and Jeff going out there and tootling around setting traps. I think probably, Jeff, you can chime in here, but I suspect he and I have actually set the fewest traps personally across the entire network.
It's probably true.
But that said, we really do want to emphasize that this scope of work is just would be absolutely intractable without the partnerships. Crab Team has at its core a group of about 225 volunteers who come from all over the shorelines. They live near beaches. They spend lots of time on beaches and are just interested in helping protect them. So the volunteers work at the early detection sites, along with a number of tribes and agency partners who also provide staff to conduct monitoring. And this is sort of what holds up the early detection network, and the management of green crab has even more partners. These are the sort of the center of that in the state of Washington is the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which has jurisdiction over this species in state waters, state shorelines. And then, of course, tribes who, as sovereign entities, manage the natural resources on tribal lands. So Crab Team works with DFW, with a lot of tribal partners, as well as some other agencies. I mentioned U.S. Fish and Wilderness Service is an important partner at Dungeness Spit, as they manage the refuge property. And additional support comes from groups like Department of Natural Resources and Northwest Straits Commission that helps in Drayton Harbor.
So a lot of partners make good work. And Emily, trapping for European crabs have mostly concluded for the 2020 season, hasn't it? Can you take stock of all that was accomplished this past year and provide us with some updates?
Yes, we do get some relief towards the colder months as green crabs are less interested in coming to traps. And as the nighttime tides tend to be the norm in the winter, nighttime low tides, we sort of wind down trapping. And that gives us a chance to take stock of everything that we've done. As with everybody, 2020 was a season like no other for Crab Team. And we are proud of all of that we were able to do collectively as an effort. For the Early Detection Monitoring Network, volunteers pulled together to mask up, to stay distant, and take on the new hurdles of monitoring in a COVID world. And of, you know, the 330 monitoring efforts that we would do in a typical year, they completed 300 of them. So an astounding rate of success, given all of the challenges of this year. In addition, the management side was able to complete more trapping than has ever been done in the state of Washington. Again, notwithstanding furloughs and hiring freezes and all of the other things that have really made it hard to scale up the efforts this year in the way that we needed to. Nevertheless, we're really pleased with the expanded capacity in the state of Washington. There's so many more people now who are trained to do this work, and that's going to be a critical component to a successful ongoing management.
Well, that is fantastic news. Thanks, Emily. And Jeff, before we wrap up, what advice do you have for someone walking a beach who thinks they may have found a green crab?
Yeah, well, certainly you can. Reporting a sighting is really, really a valuable tool. And there you can visit Crab Team's website, wsg.washington.edu/crabteam, or just look up Washington Sea Grant Crab Team, and there's a report a sighting button in the upper right. You can also go to the Washington Invasive Species Council. They have a reporting tool as well. And, you know, if you visit the Crab Team site, there's information there that you can familiarize yourself with the different species and, you know, maybe become comfortable with the different things you see. Most commonly, and we hope it will stay this way, you'll run across native species. But we certainly do want to hear about those things that that look like a green crab and are concerned to folks, and we can respond appropriately.
Thank you. And thank you both, Emily and Jeff, for sharing your expertise on aquatic invasive species and particularly on your amazing efforts to control populations of the European green crab. This is Mary Ann Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our oceans and coastlines. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kooeaks for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. And thank you for listening. Have a good day. Hatuasiku, ha. Hatuasiku, ha.